morning, everybody, and welcome to the ACSM Radio Hour. It's good to have you back today. It's worth mentioning, I think, that this is the first or the one-year anniversary, if you will, of the show. And we're really pleased to have with us today, I'm not sure how to introduce you, Bill, Dr. Lawyer Angler Bill Morton. Bill and I got to know each other a while back when he introduced me to a book he wrote called The Story of Georgia's Boundaries, that's something he wrote back a couple years ago. And so we've had some conversations since then, and Bill has a new project that I think will be very interesting for our audience. And I told Bill earlier that he is also the first in-studio guest that I've had. He's at the station today, so that's also a first for us. So, Bill, you have two firsts. You are our first-year anniversary guest and our first in-studio guest, so welcome to the show.
Well, it is very good to be here. I'm still trying to calm down because I rarely have done this sort of thing when I'm excited about doing it. And also, I wanted to congratulate you on one whole year of doing this. I've listened to several of the archival radio hours, and it's going great, and it's a great service to the audience. So thanks for asking me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. We always try to give our audience new and exciting things and not the same old, and sometimes I think people look at surveying and say, well, just how broadly can you even discuss that topic? But I've been very fortunate to be able to find good guests, and I'm really pleased to have you with me today. If you would, I did mention the doctor-lawyer thing, and, of course, the angler part, that's pretty interesting as well. I know that associates with some of the things that you're doing. But if you'd tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you got interested in this topic today.
Well, as much as I love talking about Andrew Ellicott, I'm sure this is probably common to a lot of people. I love talking about me more, but I want to keep that part of it brief because I really want to talk about my current addiction and hero, Andrew Ellicott. But basically, you know, I'm a Florida boy until I graduated high school. Then I came to Atlanta and went to college and went to medical school. And then I was in the Air Force for 3 years, stationed in Germany. Then I came back to Atlanta and did my training in urology and then practiced for 30 years here, private practice, and loved my job, loved working. Somewhere along the line, I just decided, well, let me see about being a lawyer. I know it sounds a little weird, but I went to law school at night for 3 years and passed the bar about, 25 years ago. And so all that's kind of behind me now. I retired from everything. I closed my office about 10 years ago, and I retired really from practicing law several years ago. But I became very interested for some bizarre reason in boundaries. I never really cared about boundaries, and I really never cared about surveying, but it's a big, big part of my life now. And that's what brings us, I guess, to Andrew Ellicott.
Yeah, I know that you've got a particular project you're looking at right now, and I believe you just, was it last weekend, you met with some folks to discuss it?
Right. What happened, I know that you have an audience of thousands, and so it ought to do great for my book sales, but basically I wrote a book on the story of Georgia's boundaries. I drove across the St. Mary's River maybe 8 years ago with my wife going someplace, and I saw this sign, Welcome to Florida, and I never gave it a thought before. You know, we all drive around the country and you go from state to state, but then I began thinking, who made up this boundary, and what is the boundary, and why is the boundary, and what's important about it? So that's where I started, and it took me about 3.5 years to research it. I guess if I were going to write about the boundaries, is you know, not very many boundaries of Georgia, and only four with five states, so that would take about 5 pages. But I thought I had to start really back from the beginning, which I did, Christopher Columbus, to bring me and the reader up to date about what was going on in the new world, the new North American continent. And then I got to Georgia, and then I got to the Charter of Georgia and the boundaries of Georgia. And while I was learning about it and then explaining about it, I came across a guy by the name of Andrew Ellicott, and he fascinated me. So while I was working on that first book, which came out a couple of years ago, I also was just doing a lot of research into Andrew Ellicott, and I just couldn't get him out of my mind. Because, first of all, he is important to Georgia. He did the Georgia-Florida boundary, and he also did the Georgia-North Carolina-South Carolina boundary. He marked those two eras. So Georgia finds him, includes him as being very important. But and I'll get to what we did this past weekend in just a minute. But I, what kind of bothers me about Andrew Ellicott is that he is so important to the United States of America, and very few people know about him. The surveyors know about him, and particularly those who are interested in the historical aspect, aspect of surveying. But he surveyed 14 states, more than any other surveyor really in the world before or since. He surveyed the two international boundaries of the brand new United States, the U.S.-Spain border and the U.S.-Canada border. He surveyed the District of Columbia, this 10-square-mile district, and he put a stone every mile for 10 miles, and then he turned right and did another 10 miles, and he made a big square, and those stones are still there. He surveyed much of the city of Washington. L'Enfant, you know, designed it, and it was an amazing design of that city, but it was Ellicott who came and actually surveyed the boulevards and squares and circles and put out where the Congress House, which is where the capital is, he surveyed that also. So he is so important to this country, but really very few people have heard of him, and I'm on a mission now, Kurt. My mission is to get people to understand who Andrew Ellicott is.
Yeah, I'm not sure I talked to you about this when we were talking earlier, but speaking of the district boundaries, 21 years ago, I guess, on the 200th anniversary of the of Ellicott's survey of the district, we began a project along with some other people to find those stones and refurbish them if necessary, and maybe work on the cages. They have wrought iron cages around a bunch of them. And,
right.
And the idea at that time was to actually get GPS locations on them, and it was a volunteer project, so it never really got to where we wanted it to be, but it really gave an opportunity to learn a little bit about that particular survey with Ellicott, and Banneker, of course, was his astronomer.
Those stones, you know, everything's online now. And just the other day, I was just trying to fool around and see if I could actually print on my new e-printer, you know, wireless, whatever that means, from my iPad and my computer. And I happened to just go to those stones, and they've got pictures of every single one of them in their little cages. And I've been to the one at Jones Point, as I recall, the beginning one where he started.
Yeah, the initial one, Jones Point's correct.
Yeah. But it's just astonishing what he did. And I actually have gone out into the woods on two separate occasions I've been in the woods before, Kurt, I want you to know that, but on two separate occasions I've gone there to try to experience what Ellicott did. I went on the 31st latitude, which is what I'm writing about now, which was the United States-Spain border, and tried to walk through the woods. It was unbelievable what he did. And then up in North Georgia on the Chattooga River, I mean, it's hilly, it's mountainous, it's overgrown, and, you know, I drove up there in a pickup truck and a trail, but he didn't have exactly any of those things, and he found the 35th latitude doing astronomy. It's just astounding how he survived, and he always had about 25 or 30 or more people with him, because they had horses, and they had to bring their own food, and cooks, and armed men, militia people. You know, the Indians weren't too crazy about him doing this. And he had all his equipment, wagons and horses, so it was a big deal. One of his letters he wrote to his wife, Sarah, he called her Sally, they drank a lot in those days, probably more than we can appreciate, but they certainly drank a lot of wine, and they called it silly bub. They mixed wine with milk, and I've actually Googled silly bub and found out that in England they still drink it, this wine-milk mixture. But he says to his wife, Sarah, we drink our daily silly bub, and each of us has our own cow. I mean, they were even taking their own cow with them, so He was a hell of a guy, as we say down in Georgia.
That was interesting. You were also telling me, you were talking about meeting people, and that surveyors, of course, are interested in Ellicott and all the things that he did. And when we were talking, you were telling me, just to demonstrate how tight-knit and close our surveying community is, you were telling me you met a couple of people on your latest adventure, both of whom I know pretty well.
Yes.
And it's just very interesting because we in the surveying community know that. We are fairly small. There's only probably 40 to 50,000 of us nationwide. And
exactly.
Compare that to hundreds of thousands of doctors, lawyers, engineers.
Yeah, and that is true. And it's a small community. And, you know, I have this legal part and this doctor part, and I know a zillion of those guys. But the surveyors are really almost more tight-knit. There's a lot of competition between doctors, or I should say amongst doctors and amongst lawyers. And there may be in the surveying industry, too. I don't know that much about it. But the guys that I've met are all very supportive of each other. I met Bart Craddy really about a week after this book came out. He called me, had heard about it, and 3 days later, having never known him at all, he and I made our first trip to Ellicott's Rock up in the northeast corner of Georgia on the Chattooga River, and that was a wonderful day, and I'll tell you about it as we get along. But Sid Miller, your friend, was there because he also has very much involvement with Ellicott's Rock. Walt Robillard, he's still alive, that's right, and he came on the trip last Saturday, 80 years old, and he was amazing that he did it, but I was afraid he was going to break his neck and I'd have to take care of him, and I don't know anything about broken necks. So.
And Walt's a pretty tough guy.
Yes, he is, really.
He's been around a long time, and I think, speaking of people we know, he's been an educator in the profession, and still is, for years. I think he's slowing down a little bit now, but most everybody knows him, and as you know, he's a Georgian as well, or at least he lives in Atlanta now. I'm not sure if he's a native Georgian. But,
yeah, exactly.
But we're getting pretty close to the break here, but as we progress forward, of course, we want to talk about Ellicott, but one of the things that I'd like you to talk to the audience about when we come back is Georgia's latest dispute, which is kind of part of what your book, other book was about. So let's go to break, and we'll come right back.
Quick State, the lightweight and long-lasting surveying stakes, are proud to be sponsoring the ACSM Radio Hour here on America's Web Radio. Parker Davis Quick Stakes would like to take just a moment to thank Kurt for the great job he's done for the past year, and would like to thank you, the surveyor and surveying companies that have ordered Quick Stakes for the first time, come back to us, or just continue to use and buy Quick Stakes. Your support of the Quick Stake makes it possible to help support the only radio show of its kind, a show just for you. We're all in this economy together, and Parker Davis Quick Stakes thanks you.
Do facts matter? That's exactly what Robert D'Agostino and his guests discuss every Tuesday from 5 to 6 p.m. on Do Facts Matter. You'll get the real story here on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about Quick Stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back, everybody. We're here again with Bill Morton, who's giving us some really good information about Andrew Ellicott, one of our surveying heroes, and one that he's become acquainted with as well. Before we went to break, Bill was telling us about a number of things that he's learned about and been involved in. And I know when I was talking about the water war, I was talking about the boundary with Tennessee because that sort of became a story around the country that surveyors were like, oh, boy, what's that all about? And I have a really good friend in Atlanta, Greg Johnson, who works with Georgia Power. And, of course, they had some interest in this, or at least he did. And it had to do with the placement of the line between the two states. And I know you know something about that, so you might tell our audience a little bit about it.
Yes. One thing I wanted to say, and I do want to talk about that because it's – it's a very good story. But people have asked me in the beginning along, well, what's the importance of a state's boundaries? You know, every time I've been interviewed, everybody, the Atlanta Journal, regional newspapers, what's important about the state? And at first I kind of struggled with it because I tried to think of what is important about the boundaries. But the more I thought about it and read about it, I really came, of course, to understand how very important they are. And when I explain it to people now, I think they can understand it. I divide it into two different areas. One is it's our personal boundaries. What is our identity? Who are we? How do we let people into our boundaries? And what people are not allowed to do around our boundaries, as well as our property boundaries. And we all love our property, and we want to make sure that we have a surveyor come out and tell us where exactly our little lines are around our property so that our neighbor doesn't put a swing set on our property or a barbecue. And it's even more important with a state, but it's basically the same idea. While we can get sort of highfalutin and talk about, the politics of a state and the laws of the state and the economy of the state and the citizenship, all that is very, very important. But I found the best way was it's our identity. It's a state's identity. When we go out, we like to say we're from Georgia, and everybody knows where Georgia is, and that's a lot different than being from Florida or South Carolina or North Carolina. So as my wife said when I asked her that same question, and she's just a wife, you know, she's my wife and I love her. But the first thing she said, well, it's how we define ourselves and our state. And I think that's a real simple way to put it. And that's what's important about these boundaries. And they've been measured for 200 years, since the 1700s, 300 years now. So I just wanted to bring that out. But now that you asked me about our northern boundary of Georgia, the northern boundary of Georgia happens to be the southern boundary of Tennessee and North Carolina. And that was decided in the 1700s when the Carolinas were one of the original colonies. So the 35th has been a line that's been very, very common. Georgia was the 13th colony. And by the way, Kurt, there were 16 colonies. Hardly anyone ever believes me when I say that because I never knew it until I worked on that book. But after the revolution, after the war, French and Indian War, of 1763, when England won everything, there were 13 colonies here, including Georgia, the 13th. But after that French and Indian War in 1763, when England reigned supreme, no longer was France a problem or Spain a problem. England owned everything from the tip of Canada down to the tip of Florida and from the East Coast all the way to the Mississippi River. That's about all they knew about at that time. At that time, England then put 14, 15, and 16 colonies, East Florida, West Florida, and Quebec up in Canada. They actually even had a 17th colony, Grenada, in the islands. So when I tell people that there were really 16 colonies, which there were, it just so happens that only 13 of them decided to revolt and get involved in the Revolutionary War. But the 35th latitude, the northern boundary of Georgia, was never measured, and that was a big problem. And in 1811, our guy, Andrew Ellicott, who was born in 1754, so he's already in his 50s, which is pretty old in those days. The average age was for someone in the late 1700s was 35. And he had a pretty rough life. He's been out in the woods measuring all these state surveys all his life. So in 1811, Georgia calls on Andrew Ellicott to come and survey and mark the 35th latitude. It had never been marked before. And Andrew Ellicott did come down and find the 35th and mark it. There was a county that was called Walton County that thought they were in Georgia, and they wanted to be in Georgia, and they sent legislators to Georgia's legislature. But everybody was really confused. Are we really in Georgia or not? Particularly North Carolina, who wanted more land. So Andrew Ellicott came down, found that the 35th was really anywhere from 12 to 15 miles further south than the people in Walton County thought it was, so they now immediately became North Carolinians. So that 35th was found by Ellicott in 1811, the corner, the northeast corner of it. That's all they wanted him to define at the Chattooga River, which is a big river coming out of North Carolina, and then it goes down through Georgia, and it actually runs into a couple of other rivers that form the Savannah River, and that goes all the way down to the mouth of the river into the ocean. And that is the boundary line between South Carolina and Georgia. Whoever's listening is going to have to get a map out to look at all this stuff. But to get around to the western edge of the 35th, after Ellicott found the eastern edge of it, in 1818, Georgia hired a guy by the name of James Camack. He was a professor of math at the University of Georgia. And in those days, they did have surveyors, but they also had astronomers, and they also had mathematicians. As you know, Kurt, going out in the field to find out where they were. And they said to Camack, go up there and measure the 35th, just like Ellicott did on the east side. We want you to measure it on the west side, which is the junction of the new state of Tennessee, was a new state in 1796, and Alabama. Alabama, which came along, I think, about 1818, right around that time. So Camack goes with a team, and he goes up to the ancient village of Nickajack, and that's in the charter, in Georgia's charter, where they ceded their western lands to the federal government in 1802. A lot of dates here. But getting back to Camack, he goes up to Nickajack to find out where the 35th is, and he did find it out, and he marked it. And then when he marked it at that little village of Nickajack, he started walking east, because he wanted to cut a line for about 100 miles marking the 35th latitude. And he did do that, and he did it for about 110 miles. And when he and his crew came back and they went down to Milledgeville, where the capital of Georgia was, they all said he did a great job, wonderful, terrific. How about going next year and walk from where Ellicott marked the 35th on the Chattooga River and walk westward and connect those two lines, and that we'll know where our boundary is, and we're going to build a fence. I just made that up. They didn't say anything about a fence. So the next year, 1819, Camack goes to Ellicott's Rock, and he starts walking with his team eastward. They get about 30 miles. When they get 30 miles, they kind of look down to the south, and they see 661 yards down to the south, where Camack had been the year before and made a blaze on some trees. And then they did something that only folks in Georgia can do. Rather than to correct all the mistakes they made, they just dropped an offset, a line, from where they were at 30 Mile Rock down to where Camack had been the previous year. And that's on all maps now. If you look at it very carefully, it's called Montgomery's Corner. Our boundary is not the 35th latitude. It's the line that was drawn by Camack and his team. So now that everybody understands that, and you're going to have to go look at a map and see where Montgomery's Corner is, let's talk about why that's a problem for Georgia. The 35th latitude actually goes through the Tennessee River, the huge Tennessee River. And had Camack done it correctly and gone north of the little village of Nickajack, this little ancient Indian village, he would have found that the 35th is in the middle of the Tennessee River. Had he done that, we wouldn't have the problem that that Georgia's having now, excuse me for fumbling around with this, but Georgia's having a problem with our water for our citizens because Kamak was about a mile off. And he put a stone there, and it's called Kamak Stone. And I have been to that point. It's the point on the west end of Georgia where Georgia, Tennessee, and Alabama come together. Someone stole that rock, that stone called Kamak Stone, a couple of years ago, and I was at a ceremony where Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina surveyors came, and we put a monument. I love that word. I just found out about it with surveyors. as you know, of course, what it is, being a surveyor itself. We put a monument there in the ground in cement so that no one could steal it. And that marks that point. So we're now 1 mile off. There now is a dam of the Tennessee River, and it's called Nickajack Dam. And it's of course, backed up the river into what's called, here we go, Nickajack Lake. And that lake is, of course, spread out over the Tennessee River. But it's awfully close to the 35th. There's a line there. You can drive there. The next time you come to Atlanta, I'll drive you up and show it to you. I'll send you some of the pictures that I've taken of it.
We're right at a break, so okay. Let's go ahead and do that, and we'll finish up this very interesting story that I'm sure all of our audience is going to love.
Okay.
Quick State, the lightweight and long-lasting surveying stakes, are proud to be sponsoring the ACSM Radio Hour here on America's Web Radio. Parker Davis Quick Stakes would like to take just a moment to thank Kurt for the great job he's done for the past year, and would like to thank you, the surveyor and surveying companies that have ordered Quick Stakes for the first time, come back to us, or just continue to use and buy Quick Stakes. Your support of the Quick Stake makes it possible to help support the only radio show of its kind, a show just for you. We're all in this economy together, and Parker Davis Quick Stakes thanks you.
Want to find out what land surveying is all about, new laws, history, new equipment and techniques? Then tune into the ACSM Radio Hour with me, your host, Kurt Sumner, and a special guest every Monday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time here on America's Web Radio.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Parker Davis is a patent holder and manufacturer of Quick Stakes with the 8 utility colors. And did you know 100 Quick Stakes only weighs 10 pounds? Compare that to 100 wooden stakes and the hassle of having to carry them. Parker Davis is also known in the surveying industry for their hammerless hub stakes, easy to use and easy to find. Check us out at www.quickstake.com or for a sample, call 800-438-0387.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
And we're back with Bill Morton. Bill is telling us the very intriguing story of the line. One of the things that came to mind as you were talking about that, Bill, I don't want to get you off track, but you were talking about the rivers and boundary lines being important and how we define our states and ourselves, and that actually is true personally as well. People define themselves by boundaries, whether they're their personal property boundaries or even state boundaries. I know years ago when I first started traveling around the country and telling people that I was from Western Virginia, people thought I was from the West. Actually, I said I was from Southwest Virginia is what I said, which is southwestern part of Virginia. People thought I was from the southern portion of West Virginia. So I always had to explain to them, no, I'm a Virginian. I'm not a West Virginian.
Really?
It's just interesting how we define ourselves.
Exactly.
And we're very adamant about that.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that came to mind when you were talking about the marking of this line that we're now discussing, you know, that's one of the principles in boundary is that original markers set the line, even if they don't show up where they might have intended to be.
You know, that's a great point, and I never understood it. You know, I do have a certain amount of legal knowledge, not much, I will grant you, because I confine my work really to just doing medical malpractice cases. But, yeah, it never dawned on me that, and what you just said is really important, if the surveyor was wrong when he laid it down, too bad. That's the line. That's what the law says. Is that not correct, Kurt?
Yeah, the original corners hold. And if they don't match something that's on a map, then they still hold because they're the original corners. The catch to that, of course, is proving that what you found was the original corner.
Right.
And, you know, if we're out serving subdivisions or something like that, how does one really know that that iron they found in the ground was the original iron?
Exactly.
It's hard to know. But in the case of things like you're talking about, where their physical features are something that's easily identifiable, that's true. And if you think about that, I've talked about this on previous shows, when we go west of the Mississippi or actually anywhere in public land states where it's all laid out in nice rectangles, some of those rectangles turn out to be parallelograms or trapezoids because when they were surveying the lines, they weren't perfectly
right
on the 90 degrees.
Yeah. Well, let me continue on. We were talking about Kamak being a mile off and the Nickajack Dam and Nickajack Lake and all. But now with that lake there, and you can drive to this too. There's easy road, paved roads to get to it. It's right by a cemetery. There's a road right there, and I took a picture of me standing on the road, and you could actually put a garden hose into the lake and take water out of it. You could easily, it's like a basketball court away because that lake has been there now 50 years. But that's how close Georgia is, and it is a problem. And you and I were talking about the water wars, and I know really very little about it, but what it has to do with is Georgia, or maybe Atlanta, has been taking water out of Lake Lanier, this huge lake that's just north of Atlanta, for their drinking purposes. And I remember I came to college, I hate to even say this out loud on the radio, but in 1955, Lake Lanier was just, I think, maybe a year or two old because they dammed up the Chattahoochee River to build it. And it was a recreational. I had a little sailboat that I sailed in those days, took it up to the lake, and there were like five boats on the water. It was a gorgeous lake. Now there's 4,000 boats on the water. But that lake is also what Georgia or Atlanta takes for the drinking water. And that's a big problem because the courts have now said to Atlanta, after they've been complained to by, you know, the Alabama and Florida below us, the courts have now said you can't take any water out of that. That lake was built as a recreation and not as a reservoir. And so now Georgia is saying, where are we going to get the rain from? And one of the places they're looking at is the Tennessee River. When I wrote the book, and I had also researched all the lawsuits that were involved with the boundaries, and there have been a bunch of them, I never could see how our northern, from a lawyer standpoint, I couldn't see how our northern boundary would ever be changed because of a lot of legal principles that I don't want to go into particularly. But mainly the big thing is Chattanooga, which has been Chattanooga forever, Tennessee. If we change it, it'd be Chattanooga, Georgia. And that's not going to be really, a lot of folks in there don't want to be in Georgia. They want to be in Tennessee. But what they're talking about now, and I've met with a group of lawyers who have done a lot of work on how could we not change the boundary, but how could we get water out of that Tennessee River. It's called an interbasin transfer, I think is what they're calling it. These are a bunch of environmental lawyers. They really know that kind of law. And I've had lunch with them, and they're very interested in pursuing it because they have cases that have shown in situations like this that we could actually get water out of that Tennessee River. It gets kind of confusing, and I don't want to stumble around it too much, but the TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, which I think really owns that part of the river, is involved in it. But they've done studies that show you could take millions and millions of gallons a day out of that river. It's a huge river, to satisfy our drinking, and it wouldn't harm the river at all. So there are people looking into how we actually could get this transfer of water, leaving the boundaries where they are, but get the transfer out of the river so that it could be used for the citizens.
So that am I hearing from what you're saying that is still unresolved or in some sort of mediation or something? Or,
it's nowhere. It is. They're thinking about it. The lawyers have done a position paper on it. They're trying to get it presented to the governor. I mean, it may cost $1 zillion to do this, to get pipes in there. Sort of, to me, I have no idea how they would do it. But no one has actually started doing it. But they've done a position paper on it. They've presented it to various organizations and groups. Some people are for it. Some people are against it. But that's about where they are right now. I don't want to speak out of turn because I'm not really involved in it. But
right.
My understanding of it is it's not really happening.
So when you were talking about the river being the boundary, which is often the case between states and oftentimes even between counties, is the river boundary defined just as the river and each state goes to the edge, or do you know how that works?
Which river are you talking about?
Well, either of them, from that matter. I'm just curious, because, and the reason here's the reason I'm asking that question. Here in Virginia and Maryland, the Potomac River actually is entirely in the state of Maryland. The state
yes.
boundary
yes.
is the southern edge of the river.
Yes.
And I'm
yes.
just curious if that is the case in other places, or how does one define where that boundary actually lies?
I don't know whether I should kill you for asking me this question that I hadn't considered before we went on the air, but I think I can answer it for you. First of all, most of the time now, when a river is a boundary, the definition of where the boundary is the Thalweg, the deepest in the middle part of the river.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that was very confusing with Georgia and South Carolina, because they said it was the headwaters of the Savannah River. This is in 1732. No one had ever been up there. And it stayed that way until about 1787, when Georgia and South Carolina tried to define the headwaters, and they did a pretty good job of it. They didn't really know about the Chattooga River. They knew about the Tougaloo River and the Kiowa River. This means nothing to you, Kurt, or anybody listening, but those are two rivers that are way up in North Carolina and South Carolina. And they sent our guy, Andrew Ellicott, to find out which was which, and he went up the Savannah River, and then the Savannah River is made up of the Kiowa River and the Tougaloo River, and in 1787, this is 30 years before Ellicott got there, South Carolina and Georgia agreed that the boundary would be going up the Tougaloo River. And that's why it looks a little funny. If you look at a map on the eastern side of Georgia, it kind of takes a large indentation there, because that's going up the Tougaloo River. Had Georgia said, we want to go up the Kiowa River on the right, they would have had thousands of acres and miles of property. But it looks funny there because that's where the boundary went. Okay, so he goes up, Ellicott goes up in 1811, and he marks the boundary at the Chattooga River in the 35th. But then, as it turned out, up to 1920, almost 100 years later, South Carolina, Georgia have been arguing about who owns the whole river, half the river, the Thalweg. They didn't know that word then. Who owns the islands that are in the river? So in about 1922, there was a lawsuit filed between Georgia and South Carolina. They're always heard in these interstate lawsuits are heard in the United States Supreme Court. And the Supremes at that time, the Supreme Court at that time's opinion was that the boundary between Georgia and South Carolina was the middle of the line of the river, all the way up the Chattooga River, and all the islands belong to Georgia. That's how they decided that. And as recently as 1977, there was a last lawsuit between Georgia and South Carolina about the port and where Savannah is. It's a big port. There's a lot of commercial fishing going on there. And islands, there's islands come and go, as a land builds up and it makes an island, and the land goes away, it makes the islands disappear. And so that was in 1977. I think the final decision was made in 1990, as recently as 1990. They're still having lawsuits about the boundaries, for gosh sakes.
Wow.
But the other boundary is even more interesting, the one that you are asking about, the Chattahoochee boundary, because it comes down, and this is hard to do without a picture in front of you, but it comes down from the middle of the state, and it comes to what's now called West Point. West Point, Georgia, is where the western edge of the Chattahoochee River comes down and then heads south to go down to Florida. And the original agreement between the United States and Georgia in 1802, when Georgia ceded all the western lands that they owned all the way out to the Mississippi River, they gave all that to the federal government. That, I guess it's called a contract, or they call it an agreement between Georgia and the feds, said that Georgia owns the land from the center of the river, okay, down to the 31st latitude. This is really getting difficult. Below the 31st latitude, the boundary of Georgia and Florida is on the western side of the river. So that's what you said when you asked me this question, that some of it's on the western side, like you were telling me about, you know, the Potomac. Some of it's on the middle of the river and wherever it is, and it's very, very confusing.
Yeah, those types of descriptions do make things interesting, because then when they get to the point where they change, somebody has to obviously define where that point actually is.
Right.
And
right.
So that certainly is true, and I know we're coming right up on another break here in just a minute or so, but one of the things that you just mentioned in terms of locating the Thalwig or other boundaries relates back to one of the specialties in our profession, and when we come back from the break, I want to talk about that a little bit and then follow up on the Ellicott thing.
Okay.
When you're checking out Parker Davis Quick Stakes at quicksteak.com, also check out the unique hub disc. You know, you'll be so glad you switched to the easy-to-use, easy-to-ride-on, easy-to-see, and easy-to-carry Quick Stakes and the unique hub disc. You'll tell other folks about them. So thanks for listening to ACSM Radio Hour, brought to you by Parker Davis Quick Steak. Quick Steak, the lightweight and long-lasting serving steaks, are proud to be sponsoring the ACSM Radio Hour here on America's Web Radio. Parker Davis Quick Steaks would like to take just a moment to thank Kurt for the great job he's done for the past year, and would like to thank you, the surveyor and surveying companies that have ordered Quick Steaks for the first time, come back to us, or just continue to use and buy Quick Steaks. Your support of the Quick Steak makes it possible to help support the only radio show of its kind, a show just for you. We're all in this economy together, and Parker Davis Quick Steaks thanks you.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Quick Stakes, that's Q-U-I-K Stakes, are not just for surveyors. They are great for family and community gardens. Go online to www.quickstake.com or contact your local land surveying supply dealer and get you a box of Quick Stakes. You'll love them every year when you plant your garden. Again, that's Quick Stakes, Q-U-I-K Stakes, the truly preferred way to stake and identify what's in your garden now.
And we're back for our final segment with Bill Morton. This is intriguing and very interesting, Bill. Our audience, I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of comments back from people. One of the things I love about this show is people write to me and call and even call the station and talk about how much they enjoy the topics. And having this particular topic and having a person of your stature discussing these things.
Tell my wife about my stature.
I think that's going to be very interesting for everybody listening today, because we can ad nauseum listen to ourselves, but having somebody who's done a lot of research, oftentimes what we talk about is what we believe, not necessarily what we know to be a fact. But one of the things you mentioned earlier about measuring where boundaries are in the underwater points out just how broad the surveying profession is and how specialized it can be. You may or may not have ever heard the term hydrographer,
yep.
but they are the folks who survey those land formations and land boundaries under the water. And these cases where you're trying to find that Thalwig or maybe some other feature underwater, these guys become very important,
yeah.
As well as in many other applications. But I guess where I want to go next is all of this information that you've been putting together and the research you've been doing, that's leading us to another book we can look forward to, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, and I really have focused on this. You know, I'm retired. I do have some other activities, but I'm just spending so much time. I absolutely love learning, and I love learning about this particular topic. But I'd like to talk about this Andrew Ellicott, really his most famous and most important one, even more important than the District of Columbia. And you have to go through a little history first, and that is, after the Revolutionary War now, which ended in 1783, Spain owned all of what was called East Florida and West Florida, which really went from the Atlantic Ocean all the way to and on the other side of the Mississippi River. So they owned all of the Floridas. They owned New Orleans. And this was a big problem. Spain was very, very powerful. Spain owned all of Louisiana. We think that France owned it. France did own it. They gave it to Spain way back in 1763. Spain had it for a long time until the early 1800s when they couldn't afford it anymore. But after the Revolutionary War was over, during those years, Spain owned all of Louisiana. And they had these missions. They had missions in California and in Texas and New Mexico. They had forts all up and down the Mississippi River. Spain was on the move. And here the United States was nothing. We were just coming out of a war. We really didn't even have United States until 1789. There was a period there. Everybody was just running around trying to figure out what to do. So finally, in 1795, George Washington was sworn in 1789. In 1795, the little United States and the powerful Spain, they had a Spanish armada, they had forts, they had bad guys, they had soldiers all around. They finally agreed that the boundary line between our two countries would be the 31st latitude. And they fixed that for a particular reason that I don't want to go into, but basically, that was the lower boundary of the original colony of Carolina, 31st degrees latitude. So Spain and the United States agreed that that 31st latitude would be the new boundary line. And it was supposed to go from the Mississippi River to the Chattahoochee River, 381 miles, down the Chattahoochee River where it met the Flint River. There's a lake there now called Lake Seminole. And then from that point on a direct line to the headwaters of the St. Mary's River. Now that's the boundary. What happens? They immediately get in touch with our guy, Andrew Ellicott, Washington, and Jefferson, and they say, you go down there and you survey that line. And that took 4 years to do, and it's an amazing story. Ellicott took his son Andrew Jr. with him. They went up to Pittsburgh. They got horses. They're going up Indian trails. I don't want to go over the whole 4 years, and I'm not going to. But then they meet their team there. Remember, I told you he always has cooks and axemen and chain carriers. He's got a militia because the Indians aren't crazy about this. They get on these boats. They go down the Ohio River. They're rowing. They don't have a motor. They don't have a map. They don't have a GPS. They don't have a depth finder. They get on the Mississippi River. They go all the way down to Natchez. Natchez with a fort. And there was a little nothing village there. There may have been 30 houses there. He then stays in Natchez with his team for 1 year trying to get the Spanish to get out. And they came up with all kinds of excuses. But eventually, after 1 year, now, meantime, Ellicott's down there. He's supposed to be a surveyor on this trip, the astronomer. He's not a diplomat. He's not supposed to be representing the United States. He's just supposed to be surveying this line. But he ends up having to be a diplomat and dealing with the Spanish. And he's got two horsemen with him that take all his reports back to Philadelphia to the Secretary of State and Secretary of War. I mean, it's an amazing story. They go back and forth, and all this is pretty good evidence. It's still all, you can find all this information. He stays there for a year. They finally leave. He then takes, like 2 days later, he takes his whole team down the Mississippi to the 31st latitude, and then he walks with the team, making a mark, a mound of earth, every single mile for 381 miles on the 31st latitude. But he's got to measure this thing 10 times every mile, every half a mile, because, as you know, Kurt, and everybody listening, latitudes are not a straight line. They're an arc. They're a curve. So he's got to make sure that he's on this arc. And he did a heck of a job. When he gets to the Chattahoochee River, 381 miles, the Indians give him a problem. He then gets a boat from New Orleans, sailboat, takes part of his team, sails around Florida. Wait a minute, this guy's never been on a boat in his life, you know. And I tell people I'll sail around Florida. I've got a U.S. Coast Guard license, actually, and, you know, I'll go there with my GPS and with my depth finder, with my charts, and I would like to have a motor, too. He had none of this stuff. He sails around Florida, comes up the other side, and finds the entrance to the St. Mary's River, and then he takes canoes and horses and rides up, and that's in the middle. The headwaters in the middle of the Okefenokee Swamp. I'm getting exhausted just telling this story. And he puts a mark there, and that's called Ellicott's Mound. And I've been there, and we took about 18 people there a couple of years ago, including the rangers from the Okefenokee Swamp. They wanted to go there, too, after I told them about it. So
how does that relate to the rock?
Well, how that relates to the rock is an interesting story, which just came up right now, this past weekend. This summer, remember I said that Ellicott was called in 1811 to go up the Chattooga River and mark the 35th latitude. And he did, and he marked a rock there. He inscribed it, okay? That rock is called Ellicott's Rock, and it's on the east side of the river, and there's a path to it. You have to go through the woods about 3 miles. And I went to Ellicott's Rock, and other people have been there, too, for maybe 50 years going to see it, because there is a big rock there that's got an N and a G on it. And I went with Bart, as I mentioned earlier. We went 2 years ago, and we got to the rock, and Andrew Ellicott inscribed his rock, and we're hugging each other and everything. This summer, I found a letter. Well, let me back up. There are no reports of Ellicott's survey in Georgia. There's no reports of that particular trip, and he was very good about it. And the reason why there's no report is because people claim he was never paid. I have since found out that he was paid $4,400 for this. But let's get back to why we can't figure out where this rock is, and that's because there's no report, until I happened to wander across the letter in North Carolina's governor's executive letters files. That's a mouthful, but that's where I found this letter. And in that letter, Ellicott's asking the governor of North Carolina for more money, and he says, by the way, I put a rock on the west side of the river, and I inscribed it with Georgia on one side and North Carolina on the other side, and I'm reading the letter, and I'm saying, wait a minute, this says the west side of the river. The rock we've been going to is on the east side of the river, okay? So I get all excited, and I do more research, and I'm just convinced that Ellicott was never on the east side of the river. I know we're getting to the end here, and I'm going to have to speed it up. But I, with the Sam Sog's help, they sent an email out to 1,400 members, and 50 of whom responded that they wanted to go up the Chattooga to find Ellicott's Rock. Half of those people had never seen what everybody's been calling Ellicott's Rock. But we all met in Clayton, Georgia, Friday night. We had a nice meal up there, and I told everybody about Andrew Ellicott, and I was excited. They were excited. The next morning, 21 degrees here in North Georgia. We all get in our pickup trucks, and we drive up to the same side that we went, you know, a couple of years ago to see the rock. But then several of us crossed the Chattooga River. It was low enough to do, and we got into a mess of briars and rhododendrons and swamps and rock. And we said, we're never going to find this rock. I mean, first of all, as good as Ellicott was, he may have been 100 feet off the 31st, you know. He may have put this rock 10 feet in from the river. So we really can't find it. But the excitement is that rock on the east side that has an N and a C or a G on it, whatever it is, Andrew Ellicott did not put it there.
That's really interesting. So now the deal is to find out the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say.
Yes, exactly.
We now get to wait for the book to come out. And by the way, for the audience, I know that this is going to raise a lot of interest among our audience. So what I'm going to offer is everybody who's listening knows me or knows how to get in touch with me. So if they're interested in hearing from you, talking to you, maybe getting you to come and talk to their group or something, I'll just let them do that through me rather than inundating you.
I'd love to do it. I love to talk. Have you noticed? I love to talk about Andrew Ellicott.
Well, and rightfully so. I mean, he was such an amazing character and one that people don't appreciate for the breadth of his work.
Exactly.
They talk about Washington. Every state has some place called Washington. That's why we call him the father of the country, is what I've heard. But I don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, we talk about him, and there are a lot of other people that we talk about. But when we talk about Ellicott, as you said earlier, really people are thinking D.C. for the most part.
Yep.
And even up here in Maryland, there's something called Ellicott City.
Exactly.
So people aren't thinking about all the things that he did. And it's just absolutely intriguing to learn all of this and to have had someone take the time and the effort to do all the research that you've done to put this together. So we're going to be looking for the new book, which I guess is coming sometime in the next 15 minutes, right?
The new book is coming in 2 years, probably.
Okay.
I've finished the research, now I'm writing, but thank you so much, Craig.
We're right down to the end, and I so much appreciate having you on the show, and hopefully we can do this again sometime because you have a lot of intriguing stories to tell, and we really appreciate all the work you've done for our profession, really, because having somebody provide that information is unbelievable. So thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kurt.
Thanks. Bye-bye.